Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Well, I can hear that. I hope everybody else can as well. It's a little loud. So the title of this talk is Alone Together. And I chose it because it says something to me about the particular kind of intimacy that we can experience during Sesshin, which is a silent retreat. Paradoxically, when we do very little, if any, overt interaction with others. We are instructed not to make eye contact, not to speak with others, to cultivate silence, with a few exceptions, such as chanting, occasional brief questions or instructions in work practice, and sanzen, which is meeting with a teacher. But for several hours each day, we are sitting still in silence, turning our attention inward, quieting the usual chatter of the mind, or at least disregarding it, allowing the mind to settle down and rest in the stillness. While we do sesshin several times a year, part of the reason that we say this sesshin of Rohatsu, which begins this evening, is the longest, deepest, most solemn of the year, is in what is happening in this part of the earth. The dark and the cold, the dying of plants, the slowing of daily cycles of activity, all are opportunities for us to stop and look inward, attuning ourselves to the season and allowing the earth to support us. Gyokuko recently quoted Dzogchen as pointing out that we typically connect using heads, hearts, and hands. In our daily lives, much of the time we are using our heads, that is, language, logic, information exchanges, instruction, and the like. In this culture, we tend to emphasize this way of connecting so that the heart and hands connection is sometimes harder to tap into. So I'm just realizing I want a cushion. So give me just a moment here. That one would be great. I knew there was something missing. At some point, my feet are going to let me know that this is not going to work for very long. So that should be better. So the first sesshin I attended mystified me. I felt separate from everyone, bored and frustrated because I couldn't figure out how to communicate. I didn't know people. How could I learn more about them and let them know who I was if I couldn't talk with them? I remember stepping out of the sesshin for a day to go back to work and found it a relief to talk to people. I see now that I simply couldn't imagine another way to connect. It took a few sesshin before I began to get a glimpse of how it could work. And I will say that we don't just do sesshin in this temple. We also have talks like this, classes, workshops, and informal lunches after Sunday talks when lots of talking and socializing go on. These all help us to make connections in what we may think of as more ordinary and familiar ways. Still, we often do sesshin with at least a few people that we don't know. Then other ways to connect are brought into play. Another way we may feel connection with others is through feelings, the heart connection. 2 weekends ago, I went to the Women in Prison Conference downtown. This is put on by the Oregon Justice Resource Center, which works to reform our so-called criminal justice system. One of their programs is the Women's Justice Project, which puts on this conference every year, among other activities. This year, it was the biggest yet, 280 people, with more on the waiting list. Much of the conference presented a great deal of information about our so-called criminal justice system, with an emphasis this year on domestic violence and how it affects women and incarceration. So this is very much, you know, in the head schema. But midway through the first day, there was a panel of women currently incarcerated at Coffee Creek Corrections Facility, which is the only women's prison in the state. These 5 women told their stories, and each of them had a horrendous story of abuse and neglect, trauma, and an appalling lack of survival resources. I was not the only one in the room crying. I heard sniffling all around me. There was information there, to be sure, but our primary connection was with the heart. I could feel and hear the pain and suffering, as well as the courage of each woman as she made the effort to share this difficult story with a room full of strangers. Each of them was a survivor. I felt the truth of their words and their inherent strength that allowed them to survive, and also recognized my own pain and suffering and courage, which I was able to share with them, with no words. I will say that this is one of the most satisfying elements of working in prisons for me. People don't primarily come to our groups to gain knowledge. They're looking for a way to connect with themselves and others in a real way, from a place of authenticity and wholeness. What they need from me is a listening ear and a listening heart. Listening not only for information, but also for that heart connection. My own heart has to be open. And I find the same dynamic and the same satisfaction here when I do Sanzen. Let's look now at the third aspect of connection, hands. This refers to what we do with our bodies. During Sesshin, we have a period of work practice each day where we do tasks related to the maintenance of the temple and the container we co-create on Sesshin. Several people go to the kitchen to help prepare meals for the day. Several more go to the garden, the barn, indoor and outdoor maintenance, and housekeeping. Working with our hands is another way to connect with each other, with our bodies, and with the earth. There is a way that we create harmony by moving together in a shared task. On Sesshin, we do as little talking as possible, basic instruction only, what we sometimes call functional speech. And we find that each of us focusing mindful attention on our assigned tasks contributes to the whole experience of being together. Over the course of the week, the amount of functional speech required diminishes as our connection and ways of silent communicating improve. Another aspect of connection using our hands is orioki. This occurred to me this morning as we were eating our orioki breakfast. This is a formal meal process which requires an intricate dance with bowls and cloths, chanting, opening bowls, passing food, eating together, washing and drying bowls, putting it all back together, and finally ending with everyone sitting in silence together before the last chant, and we go to kitchen cleanup. By the way, kitchen cleanup is its own practice. After our community lunch here on Sundays, a few people end up doing much of the cleanup. I'm happy that people get the opportunity to connect and socialize, but I'm sad that so many miss the opportunity to connect in a different way in the kitchen. There is a limit to how many people can work even in our spacious kitchen at one time, but if you see a lot of space and a lot of dishes still to be washed, consider pitching in as a way of connecting to the temple and other Sangha members. Way back when my late partner and I were first getting together, I remember saying that being with her was like being alone, only better. And what I meant by this was that as an introvert who recharges my mental and emotional batteries by being alone and processing internally, I found that the intimacy we shared actually fostered not only that ideal internal processing, but also expanded and enhanced it. She, as an external processor, similarly found a greater depth in our shared communication. The experience was eye-opening for me and has made possible much of my life's journey ever since. I don't think it's too much to say that if I had not had that connection with her, I wouldn't have been able to do this practice. In time-honored fashion, I have again consulted the internet for writings about Buddhism and intimacy. I found this from John Askey. In the famous Buddhist story, while the Buddha was addressing his monks, he twirled a flower in his hand and smiled at Mahakashapa, and Mahakashapa smiled in return. The Buddha then said, "I have the treasury of the true Dharma eye, the inconceivable mind of Nirvana. This I entrust to Mahakashyapa. Asky goes on, but don't grasp at the smile or the flower or even the words. And most of us do, because we love to attach ourselves to things and meanings, and it's not about things or meanings. The smile is the invitation, and it doesn't matter whether you understand it or not. The Buddha and Mahakashyapa were not speaking a secret language. Intimacy is not a secret language. Michael de Montaigne, writing of affectionate relationships, says, "In the friendship which I am talking about, souls are mingled and confounded in so universal a blending that they efface the seam which joins them together so that it cannot be found." An old Chinese poem, which is actually the harmony of difference and sameness, which we chanted this morning, begins, "The mind of the great sage of India is intimately conveyed west and east. But the word conveyed in Japanese means intimate, and this is what the story of the Buddha and Mahakashyapa is meant to convey. As Miyazumi Roshi says, the implication of identity is not just that two beings are one thing, but that there is the activity of being one. The two interact, and yet they are one. Being one is the activity of intimacy." And then I had the happy experience of running across an article by our own lay teacher, Sado Martin, on her Empty Field website. And here's what she says about intimacy. "Zen takes intimacy to a whole new level that does not exclude any state, even that of estrangement. Though we can label one moment intimate and another not, intimacy in Zen is a facet of the fundamental state in which we actually live, and waking up to that truth is the goal of our practice, from which compassion and wisdom flow. Zen intimacy rests on clarification of delusion, the conceptual ideas concerned with I am and I am not. When these dominate the landscape, the you, who is a mystery unfolding before me, disappears, and we miss the opportunity to experience the vitality and creative fullness of the moment. We stop listening, and our patterned responses to life take hold. If we want to understand this intimacy, we need to take a step outside our comfort zone. We learn how to do this in Zazen. Exactly because we don't know how to do Zazen, we are already intimate in that very act." Sado then quotes Dogen, "When you know yourself, you know intimate action. Thus, Buddha ancestors can thoroughly actualize this intimate heart and intimate language. Intimate means close and inseparable. There is no gap. Intimacy embraces Buddha ancestors. It embraces you. It embraces the self. It embraces action. It embraces generations. It embraces merit. It embraces intimacy." Sado continues, "When we meet in the absence of the idea of each other, there is intimacy. When there is just the bird's song, there is intimacy. When I am afraid and separate, yet still, there is also intimacy. With trust, creativity, and curiosity, the information we need to proceed in the world is found in the entirety of these moments." Now I turn to the theme of Rohatsu, which we do to celebrate the Buddha's enlightenment. The word enlightenment is a scary word to a lot of people. So let's look briefly at the seven factors of enlightenment as a way to break it down a little bit. We discussed these in a recent Wednesday night foundational teachings class, and these have also been themes of our annual Kids Dharma Camp. So here are the seven, and I'll talk a little bit more about each of them. The first is mindfulness, to maintain awareness of reality or dharma. The second is investigation of the nature of reality. The third is energy, or virya, also known as determination, effort, and persistence. The fourth is joy, or rapture. The fifth is relaxation, or tranquility, of both body and mind. The sixth is concentration, samadhi, a calm, one-pointed state of mind, or clear awareness. And the seventh is equanimity, to accept reality as it is, without craving or aversion. Most of us experience at least some of these in the course of our Buddhist practice. We start with mindfulness, after all, which is becoming a more widespread practice here in the West in several contexts. It is one of the skills we develop, we cultivate and develop, sitting on the cushion. We become aware of what's around us, what's inside of us, and put our attention there. Investigation also involves mindfulness. It arises out of mindfulness and then uses the four foundations of mindfulness to proceed. First, mindfulness of the body, what's happening now. Second, looking at feelings, both physical sensations. Third, we look at the mind, not to figure things out, but to observe what the mind might be telling us, the stories that are trying to make logical sense of what's happening. And fourth, we look at what's really true. Are the mind stories true in this instance? What are the circumstances we currently find ourselves in? Going back to awareness of reality. So the third factor is energy, and it's required in order to keep moving forward. It's required just to be mindful, to direct our attention, to relax, to concentrate, all of it. Determination, effort, persistence, these are all ways that we keep going and acknowledge that none of this happens overnight, and perhaps also that we're never completely done. We are always works in process. The fourth one, joy, is perhaps a little mysterious. The Declaration of Independence speaks of the pursuit of happiness, and I'm guessing this is the kind of joy that was originally meant by that. But the phrase has devolved into continued grasping at such things as material goods, wealth, fame, and the like. With a little bit of investigation, we begin to realize that these things do not lead to joy. Joy arises naturally out of all of these other factors of enlightenment. It isn't dependent on circumstances, though circumstances, like a bird singing, as Sato points out, can trigger it or enhance it. Then relaxation or tranquility is one that I relate to, as I am known as a calm person. It seems to be an integral part of who I am, one of those adjectives that almost everybody would apply to me. And I wondered during the class discussion that we had of this how it differs from equanimity, the last factor. And I think what we came to is that tranquility is simpler. It's a state of mind, almost freestanding. And those moments of calmness are something that each of us experience once in a while. Then there's concentration, which is another one that we cultivate on the cushion. I used to be pretty fuzzy on the distinction between mindfulness and concentration. And in fact, we tend to use them somewhat interchangeably, and they somewhat overlap. I have clarified it a bit, at least for myself, over the last few years. Mindfulness itself is usually broader, taking in the whole of our circumstances and everything around us. It can include the flow of thoughts through the mind, for example. Concentration focuses in on one facet of our experience, whether it be the breath, a particular sensation of the body, a sight, a sound, a touch, taste, or smell, or a particular mental formation. Finally, equanimity has to do with acceptance of things as they are. We can cultivate and experience equanimity regardless of circumstances and conditions. It's possible to be terrified or angry in equanimity, for example, accepting these states simply as what's happening now. It's not the same as indifference or passivity. It is an active acceptance and being with. And here's where enlightenment connects with the intimacy I talked about earlier. All of the activities we do during Sesshin are designed to foster intimacy and enlightenment. We simplify what we do. We take away choices. We sit still much of the day. We follow the schedule, eat what someone else has decided to cook, do tasks assigned by others in the ways that they assign them. We quiet the chattering mind as much as possible through these activities. We each do our own practice within this container, and the fact that we are all doing this at the same time begins to foster a sense of intimacy and co-creation of something greater together. Slowly, over a period of time, we each wake up to a greater understanding of our connections with each other. I want to end with the same Dogen quote that Sato pointed out earlier. When you know yourself, you know your intimate action. Thus, Buddha ancestors can thoroughly actualize this intimate heart and intimate language. Intimate means close and inseparable. There is no gap. Intimacy embraces Buddha ancestors. It embraces you. It embraces the self. It embraces action. It embraces generations. It embraces merit. It embraces intimacy. I invite all of you to participate in this Sesshin to the extent that you can. Registration for meals and overnights is closed, but morning and evening periods are open for drop-in. Check the schedule to know when you can come in. Sit down and pay attention and allow this forum to inform you. That's my talk for today. Comments and questions? Over here, Patrick.
Thank you for your talk, Genko. One of the things that I've noticed about practicing as it develops is that it does make me more receptive to other people's suffering, but it's not always helpful sometimes. Sometimes it feels very fragile and vulnerable to experience that intimacy with someone else, in a sense that it feels overwhelming. Like, I don't know how to hold it sometimes. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Yeah, I have had that experience. And it usually has something to do with being so caught up in the other person's experience that you're missing your own. So what I'm finding increasingly as I practice is that I'm not just feeling it from that person's point of view, I'm also feeling it from my point of view. And accepting it as simply part of the flow of life. So some of what can happen is when we encounter pain and suffering of any, particularly of someone else, but it's also our own, we have this immediate desire to fix it, to do something about it, to somehow equalize it, make it less. And oddly enough, when we can completely accept the pain and the suffering as just being what it is, it somehow is easier. I don't know exactly why, but that's definitely what I have found. With this situation at the Women in Prison conference, I think all of us who were around the room sniffling away because this was so hard and so painful, I don't think, it didn't seem to me like anybody was in a great deal of distress afterwards. In fact, we were uplifted by it. So, and I have found this, that if I can simply be with it and simply be neutral with it in a way, it transforms somehow. Yeah, That's about the best I could do. Maybe somebody else will have a better way to explain that, but yeah.
Thank you.
Genko, thank you for sharing about your experience with Pam and how having intimacy with her helped with intimacy in your practice.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed that I have a great feeling of aversion toward partnership right now, in part because I feel committed to practice. So I'm glad to hear it doesn't have to be one or the other.
Yeah. It's interesting. Well, I mean, in a very mundane way, she was the one who got involved with Buddhism first and introduced me to it. So I bear a great debt of gratitude for that. But really, I don't think I would have prospered in it without the fact that she saw me so clearly and that we were able to share something in a way that I had never been able to do before, and allowed me to see myself in a way I had never seen myself before. And there are definitely, you know, we learn from everything. We learn from everything, all of our experiences. And there's definitely the ways that they feed into each other without a lot of separation there.
Thank you.
Thanks, Genko. I liked that you talk about participating in Sesshin in a developmental way. It takes practice. It's something we have to grow into.
Yeah.
It is somewhat of an unnatural experience.
It is. It's kind of arbitrary in a way.
Right.
Yeah.
And I remember when I first went, I hated them. I just hated them, and it just triggered all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the biggest thing I've learned is I came into them with such a sense of separation and difference between me and others that when I didn't have an opportunity to practice the typical skills that I do to enter into a social situation with other people, because other people are stressful for me. That's my conditioning. It's a lot of work for me to be around other people. And so I had to sit with that, and I had no way to discharge it. Mm-hmm. And the delightful thing is that, you know, I'm stubborn and I persevered and got to the place where I could go and sit in silence with other people. And when that sense of separateness and difference would come up, I knew it was me and not them. Because I think I felt like it was something real. It was just an obstacle. The other thing I was thinking about as you were talking is amazing things happen when you're silent for an extended period of time. And I was reflecting on your comment, Patrick, because I remember the first sesshin I went to, I went in and saw Kyokuko and Son Zen, and I said, you know, I just have this foreboding feeling that I just need to cry and that I'm going to stop and never stop. I'm going to start and never stop.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, maybe you just need to cry some. So it was a very emotional experience because I realized all those boundaries and all that armor that I wore that started to fall away really stirred up my own emotionality and my sensitivity to others.
Right.
And they became very deeply emotional experiences as I sorted out all of that unexamined emotionality.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just thinking that sesshin for me is like just peeling off a couple layers of the onion and being more exposed
to everything. It's kind of torturous, isn't it? Yeah, it can definitely be that. And I have been astounded at the power of the sitting still. It's like, really, just sitting still and not doing it? We're not doing anything. What is this? But it has transformed my life. It's an incredible practice. I don't quite understand it, but there it is.
Thank you, Genko, so much for your talk. As someone who will be sitting my very first sesshin starting tonight, I find myself noticing a whole range of emotions, and one of them that I'm really curious about is just the like sheer excitement about it.
The what?
Excitement.
Oh, excitement. Uh-huh.
Like, I know, and I've heard from many people sort of the arduous aspect of this, but for me, right now, even though I know that things will emerge, something about what you said about the intimacy of being alone together really sparked a curiosity in me, because I think I'm actually trying to find a way to bring that into my ordinary outside life as well. And one of my fears is that at the end of sesshin, I'm not going to want to step back into
that actually to my, does happen
to into my ordinary life and and finding ways to carry that intimacy into my relationships with my partner, for example, who is not Buddhist and likely will never be Buddhist. Like, how do we share an intimacy, even though excuse me, this process is such a huge part of who I am and how I move through the world. So I'm just noticing that I'm already like thinking ahead to all these things that I can't even know yet. But finding that link between curiosity and intimacy, that's a really important link.
Yes. The not knowing is most intimate. Somebody said that. I don't remember which teacher, but there's a teacher who said that. And there's a lot of truth to that, the allowing yourself not to know. I guess the other thing that occurs to me in what you're saying is that even though this is clearly a Buddhist practice and a Buddhist form, there's no ism to it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have a label. It is, when we talk about the Dharma, we're not talking about a narrow sectarian view of the world. We're talking about reality. We're talking about the truth. So that's why, you know, my relationship with my partner actually has contributed to my practice here, and why the Dalai Lama says being a good Buddhist makes you a better Christian or a better Muslim or a better whatever it is that you want to be, and hopefully it makes you a better human being. You know, that's really the idea, is not so much to make Buddhists, it's to make better human beings so that we live in this world in a more harmonious and positive way. So I think you can trust that. Mm-hmm. You know, that is what the practice is about. It's not about trying to convert people.
So. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. Intimacy is one of those things that I struggle with a lot. I think probably quite a few of us do. I definitely spend a lot of time up here. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed for me, there's an aspect of fear for other people if I were to be intimate.
I'll say that again.
Like fear for other people if I were to be intimate, as in there's so much like baggage in the heart.
Sort of imposing that on people, or is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, going back to what Eric said, you know, like having that foreboding feeling of like, I'm just going to cry and never stop.
Yeah.
Well, like I don't want to like burden other people with, you know, like my messy crying face and, you know, crying noises and...
Oh no!
And because it comes up for me like during Zazen a lot, you know, is all this mental noise going on, and you know, sometimes it just comes in where it's like why can't you just be here? Mm-hmm. Like what are you so resistant to and just being present with. And those are the moments when I, you know, like, you know, if I'm not meditating with people, like, I'll start sobbing, you know, at home. And I think there's, yeah, just an aspect of, I don't know, I guess maybe it's a fear of judgment in one sense.
So let me ask you this. If at some point we're sitting zazen and you become aware that someone near you is crying, how do you feel?
I mean, I guess my immediate thought is like, there's a certain sort of empathy, like sadness that they're suffering, that they're sad at something. And then I think I turn to love.
Yeah.
And, you know, I get that, you know, I could probably think that other people would feel the same way if...
And you could feel the same way about yourself. You can forgive yourself for having feelings. It's okay.
Yeah. Well, I'm also doing my first session starting tonight. So I have a feeling that that'll be a lot of what I'm working with, is forgiving myself for having feelings, which is a funny thing to need to forgive oneself for, but thank you.
I will say that I have done a lot of crying in the Zendo. A lot. I have the ability to cry silently, partly... It's true. Partly because I grew up in a situation where it wasn't okay to cry, and so for many years I didn't cry, and I can turn it off just like that if it feels unsafe. But... So that when I do cry, I'm very low-key about it, and I don't want anybody to know. And one of the great things about sitting in the Zendo side by side is nobody can see you. Maybe the people up in the front. Yeah, yeah. Eric's like, oh yes, now I see everybody. Huh, imagine. There's all kinds of things that are going on with people that I didn't even know were happening. But for the most part, you don't have... And that was actually one of the things I liked about it, was that I could cry and I didn't have someone immediately coming over and saying, oh no, what's wrong? What can we do to help? I just had to be with it and let it be there and let it happen, which was incredibly nurturing for me. And once I finally like allowed myself to do that, it was kind of like, oh, I have permission. Oh, okay. It really... One of the things Gyokoko said to me at some point was that at least for women, and I suspect this is also true for men, that a lot of our emotions come out of our eyes. And that seems to be part of what we require in order to make our armor rust and fall away. Which I kind of like that image. So any of these feelings that we have, and particularly tears, I think, can be really cleansing. And they can be really a way of kind of a release of a lot of this old baggage that we carry around. All of us carry around this old baggage. And so that is, to me, that's just a part of the practice. And the fact that I ended up doing a fair amount of it in the Zendo has made it really clear to me that it's part of Buddhist practice. So, yeah, don't. And it's true that, you know, when I hear somebody crying, I think, oh, I hope they're okay. And I'll just let them work it out. You know, I have some trust that they can work it out. You know, somebody will, they'll get the help they need. I have occasionally gone up to people afterwards and given them a hug when I know what it's about and I kind of know the person and kind of have a sense that that would be appropriate and welcome. But that is by no means a universal response. So let me have them back here.
One of the most useful things of Sashin is that the bell rings and you sit, whether you're ready to or not.
Yep.
And on Sundays, you know, we prepare to come here, and on Wednesdays you prepare to come here, and you know what you're going to do, and you get ready for it. And in retreat, you don't get to get ready. So you sit down still damp from your shower, or you sit down still sleepy, or you sit down in a bad mood, or you spend 30 minutes planning how you can get out of here and what excuse you can give the shuso for leaving. And you think about lunch, and you cry, and you can't, you know, and you're mad at the person who got the shower before you, and then you're filled with lust for the person next to you, and it just goes on. You know, you get up and you work, and the bell rings, you sit down again, and you don't get to get ready. And it took me years of doing retreat to realize how precious that was, mm-hmm. that I had to learn that sitting, just sitting, meant just sitting. It meant not getting ready, not bringing something to the cushion, not having a plan or an agenda or a goal, but literally just sitting with whatever junk I had. And sometimes it's laughter as well as tears. Sometimes you're farting. You know, it's a little bit of everything over the course of Ratsu. So I just really encourage you that those who are doing retreats for the first or second or third time, let that happen. Mm-hmm. Sit with whatever is coming up and don't judge it as right or wrong, good or bad, or the way I should or shouldn't be sitting, because what you're doing is just sitting mm-hmm. with yourself as you are and reality as it is, which is can be quite surprising. And then suddenly the bell rings and that whole period has been one of complete equanimity and concentration, and there it was. You can't grab it. It comes. So it took me years to figure it out, so maybe it won't take you so many.
Or it might.
And the shuso knows all the excuses already, so.
Oh, that was a look. I think Luna had something.
Because I've used that.
Thank you for your talk, Inka. This whole business of intimacy and listening to your talk, it brought me back to my own time incarcerated. And that feeling of walking across a crowded prison yard but being totally alone. Mm-hmm. Or in a chow hall that's just crowded and watching people come and go, and there's, after a while, there's a certain amount of intimacy that comes from that. And I used to sometimes feel like I was floating and not walking, mm. and I could reach this place of mindfulness on a yard or walking down a tier where all the noise and the chaos of an institution, but just be totally alone and good with it, and sometimes not good with it, but over time, because I did a long time, learning to be okay with not being okay with something.
Exactly.
There was an expression in there, we used to say, I'm going to stay ready so I don't have to get ready. And there's a certain amount of, I guess the word is intimacy, that comes from having a relationship with yourself in this way, where no matter what happens, I'm going to be good with it. Mm-hmm. I may overreact and I may act out in the moment, but ultimately I know I'm going to be good with this. And I didn't meet a Buddhist practice in prison, but I certainly met Zen, including you there, Ginkgo. And I can't tell you, after I've been back for 6 years now, and how that cultivating that type of intimacy has marked every single part of my life. And I'm so incredibly grateful for my 10 years of incarceration with a practice. I just, maybe it's this thing where you go through the thing that you think you could never make it through, and when you get to the other side of it, you start to realize that in some kind of way, maybe I am unstoppable. Maybe the only thing that can stop me is me. Mm-hmm. There's this certain... I don't believe I've ever been to a Sesshin, but in a lot of ways, I really have. And this whole thing of this personal intimacy, it really, really resonates with me. And thank you for your talk.
Welcome. Want to see if Luna still wants to, right next to you.
I would just like to comment about crying while meditating. That particularly as somebody who's socialized male, where crying is suppressed, that there's quite a buildup of tears around the heart. Mm. I would highly recommend doing some crying.
Yes. Yes. All right. So we are experiencing our influx of Dharma School folks. We will be singing Tisarana, which is on the inside back cover of the chant book, which is being passed around.